A final discussion will be on accounting for pension plans with an asset return, which is a study done by IFREC. And we're going to have Rasmus. Are you going to give the presentation?
Yes.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. As a few months ago, IFREC issued this discussion paper on accounting for pension plans with an asset return promise. And we know that also some others of you are having projects on your agendas about what we in the paper term hybrid pension plans, that is, plans that includes elements of both defined contributions and defined benefit. And we also hope that this project can be useful for the ISB when the ISB will consider its project on pension benefits that depends on asset returns. The project, or the scope of the IFREC discussion paper and the ISB project are similar in some respects, but there are also some differences. The ISB's project, from what we have been able to see on your website, is about how to eliminate the measurement inconsistency that there is in relation to pension benefits that depends on asset returns. And IFREC's, the scope of IFREC's discussion paper is pension plans that promise the higher of the return on plan assets and a fixed return. And in the paper, we term this a minimum guaranteed return. IFREC, it's from the work of the ISB so far, it seems as if the main solution that will be considered there is what we term a capped asset approach. In this paper, we are considering also other approaches. But we are only considering these types of pension plans that I mentioned, whereas the ISB project seems to be focusing on the benefits. So no matter how this benefit is wrapped in different pension plans, I guess it will have to be defined benefit plans, the ISB's project will apply to those benefits. So when we decided on the scope of our paper, we considered different types of hybrid pension schemes in Europe, and we saw that the issues that are related to these pension schemes are very different. So it would be very difficult for us to come up with a solution that would solve all the issues unless we wanted to make a comprehensive revision of IS 19, and that was not the objective of this project to do so. We also discussed whether we should focus on pension plans where the return would depend on the assets, the planned assets, or we could just have all types of pension schemes included where the return would be linked to returns on items that were not necessarily held by the pension plan. And we decided only to focus on those plans where the assets were held by the pension plans because the risks related to these pension schemes are very different from the risk in the other pension schemes. So what are the issues with the pension schemes that we have considered? And that is that there is a strong economic linkage between the plan assets and the pension obligations. If we say that the minimum guaranteed return is very, very low, then if the plan assets, the value of the plan assets go up, then your pension obligation will also go up. But this economic linkage is not so well reflected if we apply IS 19 requirements on these pension schemes. So, and that is because you measure the pension obligation and the plan assets differently. The plan assets are measured at fair value, and the pension obligation is measured on an approach that, for example, takes into account the entire entitlement that an employee will be entitled to when he or she retires, and that you then try to allocate to the various periods. So if, for example, I'm an employer, and I promise my employee at the moment that I will pay 5% of his salary into a pension scheme, but when he has been there for 10 years, I will increase that to 10%, then you will already have to take that increase into account now. Another issue, and that is perhaps the issue that the ISB is focusing on, is that then when you try to estimate that total benefit you will be entitled to, you use the expected return on your plan assets, and then you discount it using the high-quality corporate bond rate. So what have we suggested, or what are we considering in this paper to potential solutions? We have considered three models: a capped asset return approach, a fair value-based approach, and then a fulfillment value approach. So under the capped asset return approach, as I mentioned, one of the issues is that you, under IAS 19, you will project the benefit using the expected return rate, and then you will discount it using the high-quality covered bond rate. And one solution could therefore simply just be to cap the expected return to the high-quality corporate bond rate. So that would work unless you have this backload correction. There are some, if we have tried to compare these different solutions to each other and looked at the aspects that differentiate those different approaches and found the benefits and disadvantages of each of the approach. And here, one of the disadvantages with this approach is that it will not completely remove this, or there will still not be a complete economic linkage between how you measure the assets and how you measure the liabilities. And in fact, that can mean that in certain circumstances, you will, even when you expect that your plan assets will not be sufficient to cover your pension obligation, it can be that you will not recognize a pension liability. The benefits of this approach is that if we have a situation, for example, where we have a very, very high guaranteed return, so in fact this pension plan will provide a guaranteed return, a fixed return on plan assets, then we have a pension plan perhaps that resembles very much a normal defined benefit plan, and therefore we can assess whether will they be measured kind of similarly according to IAS 19, according to this approach, and that they will, so that will be good for comparability. And also we expect that this will be one of the least costly models to implement. Then we have a fair value-based approach. We do not term it a fair value approach because the way, well, you can apply a fair value-based approach in many different ways. The way we have done it in this paper is that we have, instead of measuring, trying to measure the pension obligation at fair value, we have said we will try to measure the pension obligation at the fair value of the plan asset plus the value, the fair value of this minimum return guarantee that we are providing. This value is not the fair value of the obligation. It can be an estimate of it, but I guess if I would have to take over a pension obligation from another party, I would also like to have recovered. I will have some administration expenses, so I would charge a higher price for that, and also it can be that if I take on a pension obligation, the legislation would prohibit me from doing other types of activities. On the other hand, I could perhaps benefit from some actuarial gains. Now, in our example, in our paper, if the employee dies before he will get entitled to the pension will flow to someone else. But if that would not be the case, I could also benefit from this. So there would be some differences between the fair value of the pension obligation and then how we consider the fair value-based approach in our paper. What you could consider this amount, the fair value-based amount that is in our paper, to reflect is kind of what it would cost you to fully hedge the financial risk of the pension obligation. And then, yeah, the benefits of this approach is that here you will have the economic linkage reflected, and also if it will be that you will expect that you will not have sufficient pension assets to cover your obligations, that will also be reflected. However, it will be more expensive to probably implement, and also there will be a difference between how you measure obligations under this and then other obligations that will fall under IAS 19. The last approach, main approach we have considered is a fulfillment value approach. When we have spoken about pension obligations, people have told us, well, the pension, it seems very much like insurance contracts, and for insurance contracts we are using a fulfillment value approach, so perhaps it would also be something to consider. And that we have done there, however, some differences between insurance contracts and then the pension obligations. One element is that we do not have a contractual service margin, for example. So we have taken some elements of IFRS 17 and use those for the model. And we have then also done some other things that are not included in IFRS 17. So what we have done is that we have first tried to say, we estimate first the total outflows that we expect, what is it that we are contributing to the employee. And that is that we are providing the expected cash outflows when the employee will retire, and then we are also providing the employee with this minimum return guarantee. And from that we are subtracting what we have not yet received from the employee. And in our example, we also receive contributions from the employee. So those we have not yet received at a given date, we will subtract. And then also, we have not received the service that the employee will contribute before he or she retires. And now it can be difficult to measure exactly how we to put a value on that service. What we have done is that we have said it is approximately probably the amount that the employer will pay into the pension scheme plus the value of this minimum return guarantee that the employer is providing. And the benefits and disadvantages of this method are quite similar to the fair value approach. There is, however, a difference in that this approach is considering how it is most likely that the pension obligation will be solved. So these are the three approaches that we have considered. We have also other things in the pension paper. In the discussion paper, one of the discussions that particularly I would highlight is that we have a discussion about this backload correction. It is something we had an advisory panel to help us with drafting this discussion paper, and it was something that they mentioned many times, and it was also mentioned during our CFSS meeting. That and that is one of the issues that causes that we do not have a complete, the economic linkage is not so well reflected. Of course, there are good arguments in favor of having this backlog correction, and but because you can say that sometimes perhaps your the contributions you would make or the benefits you would allocate to different periods could be arbitrary, and that would then this backlog allocation take account for. We could also see that why in all pension plans, in fact, there is a strong linkage between what you will have to pay and when you are then when it is the contributions are made. And also, as Frank has said previously in previous discussion papers, it may be a bit difficult to understand why under defined benefit plans you will take into account what you will have to pay at the end. And say if I will have to pay more now in the future than I do now, then I have an obligation, but you do not do that under defined contribution plans. So that is a discussion that is included there. Now we have included some questions in the discussion paper that we would like from our constituents and for everybody that has an interest in the subject, and you can comment until the 15th of November. We have included also in the presentation some questions for you, and that is these three approaches, are there any of the approaches you think could be worthwhile considering further? Whether you think that there are approaches that we should have considered, that we have not considered, and if the scope of, now we have limited the scope of this discussion paper to pension plans where we hold the plan assets, whether you think that the scope could be extended. Of course, in some cases, we will have to make a few modifications then, but if you think that would be worthwhile doing, and then if you have other comments to the discussion paper.
Thank you, Rasmus. I open the floor.
Can I just ask a quick question? I read it carefully, and I was fairly interested. But between the two methods that you put out, the fair value and the fulfillment, in terms of the key results, they're very, very similar. You get exactly the same liability, exactly the same service cost. You get a bit of adjustment in the other costs. And when I look at the two sets of stars, fulfillment gets one extra star on the first question, Others are all the same. So just before we start, are you indifferent between them? Do you have a favorite? Because then it seems to me the much bigger issue becomes, which of those two should we compare with the alternative? And just, I just wanted to get a sense of your preference on those.
Personally, we can see advantages and disadvantages of both approach. What we can see, I will also explain a bit why they look so similar in the exams and the outcome looks so similar. And that is also because of some of the assumptions we have made when we have made the examples. For example, under the fulfillment value approach, in our simple, very simple example that we have used for the illustrations, we do not have any what we call insurance risk. That's for some reason in the simple examples that is not the case. For example, if we did have that, for example, then you may and then that is why we use the same discount rate both for the in both cases. And you can really go in and discuss, is that the right thing to do? Should we have made some risk adjustments to these discount rates instead if we had had other types of risk? And then you would start getting different results under the two approaches. We also think that now, of course, under different circumstances, the complexity of the different models will be very different. The fair value-based approach, as the one we have applied now in this example, will be relatively easy to measure if we have a special type of pension scheme. It is quite easy to, of course, if we hold the planned assets too, and we already measure those at fair value, to measure the part of the pension obligation, that is the fair value of the pension obligation at fair value, that will be quite easy. Then the additional element, the fair value of the minimum return guarantee, how easy that is to estimate, very much depends on the pension scheme. If it is that we have a fixed policy for what type of assets that it is that we invest in, then it should be relatively easy to measure that from a practical perspective. But if we say that, if the employee can go in and pick what shares the employee wants to have in his group as his pension assets, then it becomes more complicated to measure the fair value of this minimum return guarantee. Also, yes, you can say we will also have to measure this value under the fulfillment value approach, but there can also be the issues, for example, with the discount rates included there. So when we hear the relatively little feedback we have received so far is mostly in favor of the fulfillment value approach of those two approaches, I would say. But now let's see when we get the final feedback to see whether that will also be the case in that case. And it can also be that we get some feedback saying, why are you considering the fair value-based approach that is not really measuring the obligation at fair value? Would it not be better to have an approach that would measure it at the obligation at the fair value? And then, of course, the assessment will be a little bit different. The reason for the one extra star that you mentioned is simply that We have assessed what is it that this measure reflects under what circumstances. And, of course, under the fulfillment value approach, we are measuring the obligation as if we are going to fulfill it ourselves. It can also be, now it does not happen that often, but sometimes it does happen that entities, particularly if they are taken over, they will ask another party to honor their pension obligation, and they are paying an amount for that. Then this amount that we have under the fulfillment value approach will of course not be what at that point will reflect how it will be settled, that obligation.
Mary?
A few thoughts on this paper and the data, the information you're looking for. First, I think it's going to be very helpful to us to hear the responses that you get, although I think it'll come in a couple of different phases of consideration. People might have too high expectations for the research project that we have, which really is just looking at the question of is there a relatively easy and contained fix that could address what many people see as an accounting mismatch by doing this thing, you know, the capped asset return. If yes, we'll pursue it, even if it's not the perfect answer. If yes, we'll pursue it. If no, then we won't do any, you know, anything more. This is not supposed to be a how do we in the long term address the hybrid plans issue. It's not that that's an issue that should not be considered, but the project that we have on our agenda right now is a very focused one. So I think the feedback that you get about capped asset approach will be very useful to us in terms of whether, you know, answering questions like, is it worth addressing the in the short term an accounting mismatch issue, and how well do people think that the capped asset approach will address that? I think another question that we'll have to answer is, if people think that this is such a limited fix, or it has, you know, it's really only, I'll use the American term, Band-Aid, you know, plaster, that won't hold for very long. I think then it'll be a question of, if there's a much stronger approach that's identified, would it be better to hold off doing anything, you know, in the short term? So I can see it feeding in, but I think the responses that you get on the fair value approach and the fulfillment value probably are less directly relevant to the research project that we have, because I think it's our intention to keep this one as a very focused project in the short term. But I think also it will be very useful for informing how hard will it be to address hybrid plans, if we were to undertake a broader project. What would the scale of that project be, and is it possible to fit it, to fit a hybrid plan scheme in with existing IS-19 without it being as you mentioned in your opening remarks, a fundamental reconsideration? Because as I looked at the analysis of these different issues, the second and third, the fair value and the fulfillment value, seem to have different, let me call it different stress levels with the approach of IS-19. So you seem to be getting further from IS-19's core measurement model with, to my mind, the fulfillment value creates more stress from it. And that's, in and of itself, that's not evil. It's just, it makes it, I think, harder to justify saying this is a targeted project without being a fundamental reconsideration of IS-19. And so I think it's very useful to get feedback about the different ways to approach this, because I think it tells us something also about how big would a project be and what would have to be considered if we wanted to try and do more than the very limited ambition of the research project that we have. So I think it's quite useful. Now, something in terms of your question about are there other approaches or feedback that I'd be interested in seeing, something that gets raised from time to time around these issues are, should we just be saying split out the minimum return guarantee and account for that separately so that you'd be left with a basic defined contribution plan? And I think that you're going to get different information. You know, you'll get some feedback about accounting for the minimum return guarantee in respect of both the fair value and the fulfillment value alternatives. So it might be interesting, thinking selfishly, about our interest in this, to maybe extract what you hear about accounting for the minimum return guarantee and trying to bundle that, not just in the context of assessing those other alternatives. But I was, I thought this was quite helpful that you'll have the feedback from this. So thank you for this.
I'm not 100% sure, but it seems to me that the fair value-based approach is better than the other approaches. The discussion paper perceives that one of the main issues with pension plans with asset return promise under current IS-19 is that measurement of pension obligation and plan assets do not reflect the economic covariance and linkage between the two. And based on this perception, we think the economic relationship between the pension obligation and plan asset would be most faithfully represented by measuring the pension obligation at its fair value along the lines of fair value of plan assets. And as for the capped asset return approach, of course, this approach could artificially match the measurement of pension obligation and plan assets. But I'm concerned that this approach could result in misleading information being disclosed in the footnote. So for reference, the paragraph 144 of IS 19 requires that entity shall disclose significant actuarial assumptions used to determine the present value of defined benefit obligation. To meet this requirement, the entity might have to disclose the capped rate as a significant actuarial assumption rather than the expected rate of return. So obviously, this information does not reflect the real economics. Thanks.
Peter.
So comments on a couple of areas. One is a follow-up question from Tom's question. Rasmus, do you think the three approaches all adopt the same unit of account? Because it seems to me that what IS 19 is doing, let's take a slightly simpler benefit first of all. Let's take one that doesn't have this sort of backloading that's in your example. In that case, I think what IS 19 is doing is looking just at the benefit that the employee has earned, if you like, during the current period and current and all past periods and is measuring that. In your fair value based one, I think you're looking at what's been contributed to date and then the guarantee on what's been contributed to date. And then on the fulfillment value, you're looking at over the whole life of the employment contract.
Right.
And then considering that. So it seems to me actually the three models have got three different units of account embedded in them. And it might be worth bringing that out. It's not just a different measurement attribute for the same unit of account. I think one thing the paper does really well is separate the three effects you identify in your examples. So one effect is this internal inconsistency. Mary labelled it as an accounting mismatch. I'd just like to push back on that, actually, which we did at the last meeting, because the reason the board's looking at this capped approach is not to do with an inconsistency between the obligation and the assets, but it's an internal inconsistency within the measurement of the obligation, which is to do with the assumed return that gets in the obligation and the discount rate. So that's one piece, and that's the piece we're looking at in our research project. The second is the backloading effect, which is a much bigger question, much broader question. And then the third is the higher-off guarantee, which we know is a feature that IS 19 just doesn't cope with because it's looking at a single outcome. It's not looking at a range of different outcomes. Now, the reason our project is only focusing on that internal inconsistency is that we think it's possible to deal with that known inconsistency where we know the answer is wrong. And we think it is possible to deal with that surgically. It's not trying to address a particular type of plan. And the reason that it was attractive to us when we looked at it was, first of all, we don't need to define the population. The reason IFRIC D9 didn't work was a failure to be able to identify the population that would be subject to it. But it's self-defining because it applies whenever you have returns that vary with assets, that then you know you're in the population. You don't need to do anything more to define who's subject to it. So it's sort of very simple from that point of view. Another factor is that if you've got different benefits of the same type in the same plan, then by adjusting the cash flows, you're then able to use the same discount rate for everything, and you don't need to use different discount rates for different benefits, which would be hugely complicated with the scoping issues as well. And the other reason we thought the capping the cash flows rather than adjusting the discount rate might be useful is that some of you may remember we had a failed attempt in 2009, I think it was, to pin down the discount rate in IS 19. And we got the answer that the world, we were told it's going to be a very quick fix, and we were told that actually the world was in two completely split camps. And so it's going to be quite difficult to actually define what the discount rate should be. And this approach at least means we don't need to define what the discount rate is. But I think your paper will be really valuable input to us on that first question of how to deal with that measurement inconsistency, how big that effect is. I think actually in your examples, it's not a particularly big effect, and actually the backloading and the guarantee are much bigger effects. But that's why our project is focusing on that one known inconsistency.
Noble.
Thank you. There was little support for the capped asset return approach in our jurisdiction. Many thought that it may work in the mechanical sense, but weren't sure what the resulting information actually provided. And speaking of internal consistency, we would rather try to adjust the discount rate if at all possible, but we understand that that may be a challenge. Similar to Tom's comment earlier, we had difficulty understanding the difference between the fulfillment value approach and the fair value approach. We would want more elaboration on that if at all possible. We got the impression that this was actually trying to split the plan into two components, one more or less a DC component and another a guarantee component, as Mary referred to. And if we can clearly define this guarantee component, it may be possible to extend the scope of DC plans so that some of the plans that are currently accounted for as DB plans may be accounted for as two components, one a DC plan and a guarantee. Having said that, we could not distinguish very much between the fair value approach and the fulfillment value approach. When we consider that we have two components, we did not think that the use of OCI would be appropriate in either way. We just did not see that as a concern.
Cédric.
Thank you, Hans. The issue has not been really mentioned by our constituent in France, so I'm not sure it's really identified as a current issue in France, maybe because of the because such pension scheme do not actually exist. I won't say that, but I'm not sure it's a big issue, so I have no strong view at this stage. But I have some sympathy for the project and would like to make sure that we focus on the cost-benefit analysis, because in my understanding, the question here is rather a cost-benefit analysis than a conceptual issue. And in that regard, probably, I would be very cautious in identifying new schemes or new measurements that would be slightly complex compared to the objective, because in my view the primary objective of IS19 is to allocate cost to wages or to the remuneration of the work that has been done. So it's a service cost rather than identifying the right liability. So there are some shortcuts in the methodology under IS19, but the major objective is to have a kind of allocation of that cost among the different workers that makes sense and is easy to follow. And in my view, we should really have that in mind when we consider the different models. And in that regard, I am struggling what is supposed to represent the best economic or provide the or reflect the best the economic of the situation. And I have some sympathy for the first asset capped analysis, because it's first it is simple. Second, I'm not sure to really grasp what is not anticipated in the fair value of the asset that allow me to build up projected value in addition to the fair value that would be higher than the expected risk-free discount rate. So I have some sympathy for the risk-free discount rate in that regard. And once again, I would really focus on the real volatility that is reflected in the service cost, and as to whether it is necessary and it actually reflects the performance of the work that has been done. That's what I wanted to comment. Thank you.
Paul?
Thank you. Like others, we failed to really see the particular advantages and disadvantages between the two models, the fulfilment and the fair value model. And a question in terms of, and it's perhaps the point that both Mary and Nobu have made, is the extent to which, had you treated this as a defined contribution scheme plus a then fair value the minimum guarantee, would that result in a materially different outcome to either the fulfilment or the more likely the fair value model? And I'd be interested to see whether you tested that, because I do think from looking at it that just sort of leaps off the page as being, well, why wouldn't you just look at that? And the third point I would make, which is really just an observation, which is I think that this paper and other work that you've referred to, I think just goes to emphasise that whilst we accept the ISB's got this fairly narrow scope proposal or project at the moment, research project at the moment, it will increase the pressure on increasing the prioritisation of a more substantive project around pension accounting.
Do you want to respond, Rasmus?
Well, yeah, I can just, because now I think it has been mentioned twice, you know, the difference between if this was just a similar to a defined contribution plan plus the fair value of the guarantee. Of course, I think the fair value model, as we have, it would result in the same net amounts. However, if we go into the discussion of whether we have a defined contribution plan plus the fair value of the value of the guarantee, I think there is also a discussion, is it this instead a defined benefit plus a fair value of a variable contribution? And that discussion you would then need to have.
It just makes it easier doing it the other way around. But.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm going to share the comments from ALSSG members. On this topic, we received comments from two members. They are Australia and Korea. But the comments from Korea were already shared, so I'm not repeating the comments from Korea. Then what I'm going to explain is comments from Australia. Australia supports the capped asset return approach from the cost perspective. The other two approaches would be costly to implement, and also the other two approaches may delay the process for the current financial reporting. I would like to mention for question two, no specific approach was suggested. For question three, it should be largely possible, at least for the capped asset return approach and the fair value-based approach. And for question four, one issue was noted on the discount rate used in the fulfillment value approach. Under the fulfillment value approach, discount rate will be based on assumed returns on plan assets. Such a discount rate will be inconsistent with the principles of discounting in measuring the fair value of liabilities. And also, it will be inconsistent with the principles in IAS 19. That's it. Comes from ALSSG members.
Leonardo.
Thank you. The pension plans within the scope of the discussion paper are not common in Italy, and so at the moment this is not a big issue for us. That said, we prefer the first approach because it seems easier to apply and similar to IAS 19. The other two approaches are interesting, but seems to require a more fundamental review of IAS 19, while the first one may be done with an amendment on IAS 19. So, on balance, we suggest to further explore the first approach. Thank you.
Any more comments or questions?
I just want to clarify that I raised the point about the pulling out the information about separate accounting for the minimum return guarantee, because it's something that we hear a lot whenever we're talking about this area. I didn't want to imply that I think we should broaden our research project to include consideration of that, because I think the only way we're going to do something meaningful is by an up or down on the capped asset approach. But I do think it would be very interesting to harvest whatever information we could from your responses about that. That I just didn't want to let Nobu and others walk away with false hope.
Tom? Just a final comment on the on contribution plus guarantee. You'd mentioned that it sort of you could always look at it the other way, where if the guarantee is a really high rate, it's much more likely that you'll actually just pay that rate and it becomes almost like a defined benefit. So you have these two poles. When you go to write it up, will you have a sense of what the universe is? For example, are the majority of these plans such that the guaranteed return is so low that it's highly unlikely that you do the guarantee, or the majority of them at the other? And if that matters, when you write it up, it sounds to me like if the guarantee is very low, then the idea of defined contribution with a guarantee that's not going to be used very often starts to make more sense to me. And I'm not sure of that, but it would be good if you could tease out and maybe something about the universe of these plans, and does it matter what the universe is when you summarize?
Peter?
A couple of other thoughts on the back-end loading. So, because that seems to be one of the big drivers in this particular example. And it does seem a bit odd to people when you've got something that's very close to defined contribution, but if you've got some big backloading going on, that you get different answers depending on which side of the cliff you fall. And the simple thing is to follow the contributions, but then, of course, that's very difficult because you can get some very extreme examples. I mean, the most extreme would be there are no contributions until you retire, or even you pay as you go in retirement. And then sort of following the contributions is going to give an answer that's not going to seem very sensible. So I think teasing out what to do with, if anything, with the back-end loading may well be one of the things that's most sensitive and that sort of brings up the biggest issues in this, but may also be quite difficult to deal with. Thinking a little bit about what one might try to do if you try to reform pension accounting a bit, it seems to me one thing that was missed in IAS 19, and I should plead guilty as I was a project manager at the time, is that we failed really to consider the interplay between vesting and non-vesting. So IAS 19 says ignore the distinction between vested and unvested, and you just include everything in the pot. I think if I was designing it today, I'd do it slightly different. I'd say that once it's vested, it's sort of like a financial liability in a way. It's already there. It's clearly crystallized. But if you're going to bring in any non-vested element, then what you do up to vesting is essentially arbitrary, because you could write it in lots of different ways with the same result. It makes no difference during the period when it's unvested. And so it might be the longer-term development might be to look at figuring out what you want to do at the point where it vests, and then have something that's reasonably close to financial instrument accounting because it's quite similar, and then figure out some pattern that you do during the vesting period to get up to that point. And so in the back-end loading case, if you followed that kind of thinking, you'd be applying that lower level in the early years and then the higher level in the later years. But that's an entirely personal thought, of course.
Okay. Well, I think that brings us to the end of these deliberations and to the end of our meeting. Thank you all for coming to London. Wish you all a safe trip home. And we'll see each other again in October, I believe. Thank you.
Thank you.